A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association suggests do not resuscitate orders may prompt caregivers to forego treatments that patients would have wanted. We'll talk about the implications of this study in this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. practicalbioethics.org. Dr. Karen Porter Williamson joins us. She is Medical Director of Palliative Care at the University of Kansas Hospital. John Carney joins us as well, President and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. John, let's start with you. This study focuses on treatment preferences expressed by some 25,000 people in Oregon through a document called Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or PULSED. It's filed in a state registry. What did the researchers find that you found from the study, and did any of their findings surprise you at all?
What the researchers found is that people who fill out forms to limit their care at the end of life they really aren't saying they don't want everything or they don't want anything. And what we don't know by the fact that we've utilized do not resuscitate forms in the past is they aren't sophisticated enough documents to ferret out what the issues really are for the patient and the family. So we kind of reinterpret a do not resuscitate or do not take care of this patient. I mean, it's basically don't treat the patient as opposed to, no, there are things we should do and can do for this patient, but we're not doing it because they present with the DNR. And this research is really saying there's a better way for us to do this in this country rather than rely simply on do not resuscitate forms.
Dr. Porter Williamson?
What I took from the article was that the conversation about goals of care and about what interventions people would want to see happen or not see happen if they were getting sicker is pretty highly nuanced, and that we as medical providers cannot overinterpret one order about a life-sustaining treatment with the cadre of orders that we really need to consider in somebody's global care plan when a patient is really sick. And so, for example, in the study, they looked at the percentage of people who wished to have a do not resuscitate order and found that 50% of the time, those people did want other types of medical interventions that, if those things could be thought to be helpful, and that we have to be very aware of that as medical providers in thinking through and not overinterpreting a DNR order to mean more than it does, which actually means what happens in the face of a full-blown cardiopulmonary arrest.
So there's still some gray area. John?
There is. I think that for most Americans, though, who look at, you know, what do I want to do if I've got an advanced illness, if I'm struggling with kind of care that I really can benefit from when I go into a hospital setting, most of us assume kind of default assumptions that everything is better, and that isn't necessarily true. And the tool that is studied in this document is not the old do not resuscitate form. It is an emerging form that's being addressed in a number of states around the nation that sophisticates this ability to kind of differentiate what those goals of care would look like when you start treating this patient. And it ferrets out some of those issues that simply cannot be, as Karen mentioned, simply can't be overinterpreted by somebody who's looking at a single order. They have to be able to have some sophistication to it. So that ability for us to dig deeper, to drill down and really find out what the patient wants in terms of their goals of care, has to be reflected in physician order sets, and that's what this document does.
And Dr. Porter Williamson, this involves a population that's already very vulnerable, correct? Frail, perhaps at the end of life?
When we talk about people who are where we need to be considering these types of conversations, it's patients where they or their physician, their family, would not be surprised by the answer to the question, could I die in the next year? Or would I be surprised if my patient or if my loved one were to pass away within the next year? And so when a patient's in that type of situation, it's not unusual that they have many health problems that are building up on them, not unusual that they are in and out of the hospital because those medical conditions are becoming harder to keep controlled without emergency medical intervention. And what I really love about the type of form that this is, and I don't know if we've talked about that this is a pulsed type of form or the physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment, but the good thing about it is that for patients and families and their care providers who realize they're in this situation, they can really talk through if the bottom drops out and there becomes an emergent situation, how would they want the medical system to respond to meet their healthcare needs the best? The default answer in our healthcare system, which is good for the majority of people, is that all possible interventions that can happen do happen. Some people, as they approach, increasing frailty or comorbidity, and they've been in and out of the hospital and experienced that healthcare system, say, you know what? I don't know that I want the healthcare system to respond in the default manner. In order for those people's wishes to be respected about how they'd want the healthcare system to respond, we need systems in place that help to address what they would want to see happen. And the pulsed paradigm and our program that we've been working on here in the Kansas City Metro and this region called Transportable Physician's Orders for Patient Preferences helps to address that need and create a system of care that represents and respects patients' wishes as they face these kind of decisions.
So, John, this is this, I don't know if you would call it a next step, or is it building on Pulsed, this transportable physician orders for patient preferences, what we lovingly call TPOP. Is it building on Pulsed? Is it taking a different direction?
No, it is. It is a pulsed paradigm model. I think Karen mentioned earlier the word paradigm, and there's a series of 9 sets of rules that you have to follow in order to consider the initiative that you're working on pulsed like. And we've done that. We've adhered to all 9 sets of those rules, and we've implemented this form in the same way. I think that the extra step that we've gone is really try to marry back some of the issues that she talked about, marry back the order set from the doctor to match the patient preferences. And that's why we changed the name to patient preferences, focusing more on what the patient wants, what the patient describes as their desires are related to their treatment preferences, as opposed to just a doctor sitting down and writing a set of orders. So it is that kind of, it's not just about turning flipping the switch on and off. It's about kind of really looking at the gray area and saying, what is best for this patient? What do they say they want? So what do we need to do in order to write the order set to match those preferences?
Now, in the state of Oregon, they had a state registry that's involved with their program. Is that a key element in Kansas and Missouri? There's not a registry. Is that something that should be considered in states that want to implement a pulsed paradigm?
I think the advice we've gotten is that at the time that it was initiated in Washington and Oregon, there really wasn't any other way to collect the information. We know that within the course of the next 3 to 5 years, there's going to be ability for us to capture this information electronically and host it in a different way. So the registry was very, very important in them gathering the information and being able to do the research. That is absolutely unquestionable. But they've advised us, if you're not there yet, there's going to be a way for us to collect this information and share it more broadly in the future, and it won't be in a separate little registry that we do just for this form.
And those kinds of registries come down through state laws, and it's part of a state program, is it not? Or am I misunderstanding that?
It is, and in order for them to actually adopt it in the state, that states that they have, they actually had to create a statute in order for them to be able to do that and to get funding to be able to say this is where your information is going to go.
Does this study prompt you to think differently about how to approach these kinds of situations?
I think that there's a quote in the article from Eric Frommey, and he is in Oregon, that I thought was very, very important. And he said that in these types of conversations, they very many times too often start with the question about code status or about the DNR order, when what we need to be starting with is the conversation about what the patient is hoping to see happen with their medical care based on where they're at in their medical condition and in their experience of illness. And that when we do a good job of discussing prognosis and helping the patient and family to understand where they're at, and then marrying up that medical condition and what the medical system is expecting to play out over time, marrying that up with what the patient and family's values are about how they want to approach their medical care in light of those facts, that creates the right answer on these forms. And that the last question we need to be asking is the resuscitation status question, after we really have a good understanding of where that patient's at in their illness and how they want to live as best they can with that illness.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we call this a paradigm. It really is a shift away from this traditional, you know, kind of default approach to medicine, and says, look, let's get the family in here, let's get the patient in here, and let's discuss this and find out what their preferences and values really are. And then let's use that as the basis for the decision we make related to the recommendations we make about their treatment and the order that we do, so that we're really looking back to those cues and those understandings and honoring and respecting those patient preferences.
You know, I still take a look at the study, though, and it seems like there are some contradictions, a little bit of conflict, I guess, or people are conflicted about it. When they have 72% of those in the registry did not want CPR, but many wanted other treatment. About 55% wanted the option of antibiotics for infections. Is it kind of a moving goalpost, or is that something that is kind of typical for this kind of situation?
Yeah, I wasn't surprised at all by that. And that experience of saying, you know, I want you to try to do everything that you can that you think may be helpful for me. If my heart stops in spite of you doing the things that you think might be helpful, well, then I want you to let me go. And that is a perfectly logical approach. And so, no, I think that that it's not an all or none sort of deal, and that people can land very logically and appropriately a lot of places on the spectrum, and that these how people feel about this continues to evolve over time as they live with their illness. And so this is not a one-time thing. It's a process of understanding between the care providers and the patient, between the patient and their loved ones, about how they want to live and how they want to live as they live with progressive illness.
And somebody who's diagnosed with the terminal condition and is advanced in their illness may even change even over the course of that time. You know, that the first time I go to the hospital and it wasn't that burdensome and everybody was saying, go for it, you know, I may have made decisions. But when it becomes the third and the fourth time in the last 6 weeks that I'm here, that's going to change that. And that's, this document, again, is dynamic. It's a living, breathing document that allows you to be able to say, all right, we checked this box last time, but we're not going to check it when we leave this time. And hopefully, in some cases, getting to the point where the patient never has to come back to a setting where the kinds of things we can do to them isn't really necessarily helpful to them.
John Carney is president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. Dr. Karen Porter Williamson is medical director of palliative care at the University of Kansas Hospital. For more information on the Transportable Physician Orders for Patient Preferences Initiative at the center, visit practicalbioethics.org, practicalbioethics.org. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.